These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, Embodied Resistance, the Science and Continuities of Africana Fighting Arts with Kamal Rashid. Africa World Now Project is next. The notion, assumption, and our idea that the various peoples who were enslaved during the periods and processes of the solidification of the racial global economy that claims our ancestors were deprived of culture, stripped of all associations with historical and ancestral groundings, is a product of centering European historicity as the dominant expression of social, historical, political, and epistemic knowledge systems. This argument is rooted in the fact that one of the most vibrant places to find the most articulate expressions of Africana humanity is in the way we resist injustice, inequity, violence. The way we conceptualize and engage in struggle against systems of oppression, the foundation of which is an advanced understanding of the praxis of being human. See Everything, Sylvia Winter. Africana struggles operate on multiple and simultaneous levels of human existence. It always was, always will be, to realize a world beyond. The material and non-material praxis to balance forces seen and unseen. The science of Africana fighting arts, a commitment, conscious or unconscious, to embody resistance of becoming a rebel. Building on the work of Dr. Kamal Rashid, I assert that becoming a rebel can be understood in the Swahili tradition, Harakati Zawasi, translated as movement of rebels. For Dr. Rashid, it represents the tradition of radical resistance that is embedded in the history of capoeira and other African diasporic combat arts. These arts were used in the people's resistance to state oppression throughout the Americas. Harakati Zawasi seeks to honor these traditions by seeking to engage in the rigorous study and practice of the theoretical and technical applications of African combat systems. Additionally, Dr. Rashid and the collective seek to broadly disseminate these arts within the African community for the sake of facilitating cultural transformation. Today, Embodied Resistance, the Science and Continuities of Africana Fighting Arts with Dr. Kamal Rashid. Dr. Kamal Rashid is an Associate Professor of Educational Foundations and Inquiry at National Lewis University in Chicago. Kamal earned his PhD and BA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a Master of Arts degree from Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid's work focuses on African-American history and culture, particularly on the intergenerational dynamics of Africana social critique, which includes an exploration and theorizing of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as contemporary African-centered scholars and critical race theorists. Undergirding this, he studies art, hip-hop, and comics as a radical public pedagogy. He is co-developing an oral history and archival project focused on African-American social movements in the Chicago area from the 1960s to the 1980s with Dr. Richard Benson of Spelman College, and is currently working on Finding Our Way Through the Desert, Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, as well as the critical theory of W.E.B. Du Bois, The Struggle for Humanity. He has published a number of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters and received various grant awards to support his work. Lastly, and most importantly, Dr. Rashid is active in a number of community organizations in the Chicago area, including the Kemetic Institute of Chicago, a research and educational organization focused on mapping, exploring, and applying the ancient contributions of Nile Valley civilizations. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Enjoy the program. Thank you for taking the time to join us today, Dr. Kamal Rashid. How are you doing, brother?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
And thank you for taking the time to really talk about a very, very interesting but important conversation with a longer genealogy than I think that people really understand. And that is, when I say people, I'm talking across the board, across categories of associations, right? So, and the topic that we are actually going to be talking about today specifically is something that is called, or should be aptly called, African or Africana fighting arts. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, you know, is near and dear to my heart. Growing up, playing different fighting games with my dad. He would come in the house late from work and I'll be laying in my bed just, you know, waiting for him to come in because I knew we was going to have a battle. and my dad and I actually love to watch martial arts movies, mm-hmm. the old school ones, like the, you know, the mouth moving and voice not matching up, you know. And yeah, the classics, you know. And also, truth be told, there was a brother in our neighborhood who was a practitioner, really piqued my interest because he would teach me outside of whatever he was doing as well, actually in the neighborhood, at the parks and stuff like that. So, you know, it's near and dear to my heart. I wouldn't say that I'm an expert in it. It's just, that's my association with the topic. But having also somewhat familiarity with the literature, I thought it would be important to have this conversation with you. And I want to approach this conversation in three different ways. And the first way, or the first category that I want to approach this conversation is a discussion of its practice, or the fighting arts practice, its philosophies and its purpose in Africa itself, its origins, you know, its combat combat traditions across the African continent, and also delinking the notion of martial arts from this limited perspective of an Asian, right? So I definitely want to be able to do that. And we really want to talk about this, you know, in the context of, you know, the origins of the practice itself of the fighting arts, because I think, again, its philosophy and its purpose is, you know, the origins of African fighting arts becomes important. The combat traditions across the African continent, West Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, but I also want us to really dig into or address the delinking of martial arts from it, from its limited perspective of being Asian in origin. Okay, that's the first category. The second category, and I'm going to go through these again because I know there's going to be a lot here. The second way I want to approach this critical conversation is through a discussion of embodied knowledge and memory in the diaspora. Like movements, you know, we talk about fighting arts, but the movements were also functional. It were not, you know, they obviously had a purpose of protection and defense and offense, but there was something linked obviously to the universe, to nature as well. And the third one, which I think is probably a very interesting conversation, particularly in the context of this violence that's happening around us, the usefulness and necessity of African understanding African fighting arts in the context of white supremacist violence. So to go back up, and then I'll let you dive into it, and you know, we'll kind of, you know, map it. Let's deal with that first category, the discussion of the practice, the discussion of its origins, discussion of the combat traditions across the continent, and also de-linking martial arts, or the notion of martial arts from its limited perspective. Yeah. Dive right on in there, brother.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I also start with the second part of that first in terms of the delinking, because I think one of the things that's interesting, I have this bad habit, I'm putting bad in quotation marks, habit of reading multiple books concurrently. And one of the books that I'm reading right now is a book, I think it's called Creating Wing Chun. And so it's a very good piece on the history of Wing Chun in terms of how it formed in Southern China in the 19th century. One of the things that's interesting that comes up in the beginning of the book is this question around terminology, like how to refer to Chinese martial arts. And what was interesting is I thought about this, and this is something I've been thinking about for a while, is this idea of martial arts as a certain type of social activity is inextricably linked to the way in which we, most of us, have come to encounter this idea. Of most of us, the vehicle through which most of us have come to know of this thing called martial arts. And this is something that I've been hearing in different ways over the last really couple of decades, I guess decade and a half, you know, for all the time I've been in this. I remember back in the 2000s, I would hear people like Ahati Kalindi Iyi would refer to the fact that when he would travel to Africa, that it would be, you know, asking people to show you their martial art would might receive the response to that might be question looks of bewilderment. Instead, asking people how they stick fought or how they wrestled might be more efficacious, you know, queries. Even my capoeira teacher, Mestre Portovello, we were talking recently. He was saying that even like in his time, he was saying that people who were around his age like had this idea of that martial arts constituted these combative traditions. But even if he were dealing with people that were older than him, for them, martial arts is something that's from Asia, right? And I think what we're dealing with is this idea of martial arts as a signifier, right? Martial arts is a signifier that most of us, I guess, in this point, have come to encounter. Listen, when I say at this point, I'm talking like since the 1970s, from the 1970s to now, that most of us have come to know as a result either of mass media, particularly Hong Kong cinema to a large extent, secondarily the monetization, the commercialization of martial arts instruction, especially in this country, and maybe the third element of that would be the and this is really over the last 30 years, but probably more significantly in terms of the last 20 or so, is the popularization of the mixed martial arts. And so inevitably, given that most of us have come to know of this thing as martial arts through this process of commodification of these combative traditions, it inevitably points us to Asia as the place where martial arts come from. And so this tension comes up in a lot of interesting ways. There's a colleague of mine who I, you know, he in fact is, he was, I don't know if he was critical of me or critical of the idea of even calling African combat traditions martial arts, because, you know, he insisted that to refer to them in that term inevitably, you know, link them to this Asian conception of fighting. And so I appreciate that, because, yeah, I mean, martial arts or these combative traditions or fighting traditions, as far as we can tell, these are culturally universal. You know, as far as we can tell, everybody had modalities of combat. Dr. Edward Poe does in his book, he has a book about the combat arts of Northern Nigeria. And one of the things that he talks about, he provides these typologies of the combat arts in Northern Nigeria. And I think these typologies are actually useful for thinking about this range of social activity that we call martial arts today. He talked about arts where you have people fighting people, so it's scenarios where the adversary is another person. You have, and then he went into this idea, I think, where you have scenarios where the adversary is oneself, you know, such as like the Fulani have a flogging ritual, you know, and the idea is to, again, overcome one's own desire to avoid pain. And then he said there are scenarios where you have martial arts where people are essentially engaged in combat against nature, or the adversary is nature. And I think in that context, he was actually referring to Melanesian arts. But the point is that when we look around the world, we find different approaches to wrestling, different approaches to stick fighting, different approaches to boxing, and or other types of combative games. So when we look at the African martial arts and their origins, what's interesting, I guess, if we start as far back as we can start, right? You know, in terms of where we have documented evidence. And of course, ancient Egypt would be that place, right? There's people often talk about Beni Hassan and how on the walls in Beni Hassan, you have all these renderings of wrestling. And again, a lot of these are, you know, people will comment on the fact that these are moves that are still in wrestling today. It's kind of interesting. Well, let me say more. I'll say more about this, about wrestling in ancient Egypt or ancient Kemet, and then I'll come back to the present. You know, so you have various stick fighting styles in Egypt. In fact, Tatib is an art with a long stick, or a naboot. And in fact, that art, their efforts today, in fact, to revitalize that art, and was one of the interesting things that's happened with it is something that we see that's happened to many fight traditions around the world, not just Black fight traditions, but it's taken on this folkloric element. That is, you know, fighting arts have a combative dimension, but many also take on this folkloric or performative dimension, and we certainly see this with Tateeb. They had another, you know, they had blade fighting arts. In fact, there's a brother in Austin, Texas, Demian Stith, who makes training weapons. And so just a couple of weeks ago, I got a two wooden kopeshes. So the kopesh was a curved blade from ancient Kemet. It almost kind of looks like a question mark in a way in terms of its shape. And they were very little. And when I got it in the mail, I was like, you know, I texted the brother. I was like, are these built to scale? So he texted me back and he said, yeah, they are. And my son was nearby. My son, you know, he was explaining, well, you know, they were made of bronze historically, and bronze weapons are smaller because of the relative weakness of the metal. I was like, oh, okay, I'm glad I got a scholar in the room to explain this to me. Yeah, so that was edifying. But the point is that they had javelin throwing. I mean, they had you know, boxing. The boxing is not very well documented. There are renderings of people in boxing postures and situations where people appear to be throwing blows, but we don't have a lot of information about it. The point is that we know in ancient Egypt they had fighting arts. And what we see throughout the continent, we see other types of fighting traditions. As far as I can tell, like when we look at Africa as a whole, we tend to find three different modalities of combat art. Wrestling, that is stand-up styles of grappling. Boxing, that is styles where people are striking with the hands and in some cases the feet. And weapons arts. Arts where people are fighting with sticks. A lot of stick fighting, and in some cases, blades. And how the orientation of the blades reflects a lot of diversity. One of the things that is interesting about how martial arts appear to be practiced throughout the continent is that, to a large extent, the arts themselves are within the domain of ethnic groups. You know, and so the Nuba people of Sudan, for instance, have wrestling. And in fact, there's some people who speculate that their wrestling is in fact what the wrestling in ancient Egypt was like. But the reality is that when we look at most of the wrestling I'm aware of, whether we're talking about Lam, you know, wrestling in Senegal, or whether we're talking about Igbo wrestling, it seems like the wrestling in much of Africa follows very similar rules, whereby if the person is thrown to the ground, they've lost. You know, and I want to come back. I'll say something a little later on about maybe the possible purposes of that. But wrestling, you know, you have wrestling arts. And I think it's fair to say that these wrestling, that people have been wrestling on the African continent since time immemorial. You know, the fact that we see parallels in terms of the philosophy, the type of rules or protocols pertaining to wrestling is in and of itself very interesting and perhaps may not be coincidental, right? You know, it may have some significant implications in terms of knowledge transfer, you know, at some point in the past, who knows? But it is very interesting that, you know, from East Africa to West Africa, we see this very interesting continuum in terms of the protocols of wrestling. The boxing arts, you know, what's interesting, so like some people have speculated with respect to boxing in ancient Egypt because of some of the pictures. And again, it's not a lot of iconography, but some people have speculated that their orientation of boxing was one whereby one hand was used as a spear, since a striking hand, the other hand was used as a shield. And you do find at least one group who sustained that an orientation of boxing that is basically spear and shield boxing is what some of us have started to call it, which are the Hausa people in Dambe. And again, you have like one hand and it'll be bound up in rope or some kind of fiber. And that's what's used for striking. And the other hand is used for parrying, sometimes for trapping and things like that. You know, and again, you know, it's hard to figure out, like at least right now, I don't think anybody has definitively traced the origins of these things, but it's kind of fascinating when you look at this in contrast to the oral tradition of the Hausa, who speculate that they came from, I think, Western Eurasia, you know, which is kind of interesting. You have so boxing, you know, you find much more wrestling than boxing. Then you have other groups that have these stick fighting traditions. You go to Southern Africa, the Zulu, the Xhosa, there's definitely a spear and shield orientation to the boxing. One long stick serves as a shield, another stick is for striking, that's the spear. You find in present day Angola, There's a style of stick fighting, and I forgot what it's called, where it's a short, relatively short stick, and it's held right in the middle. I'm not sure how it's used. I was just seeing a little bit of it in videos, but I wasn't able to make sense of what I was looking at. In Ethiopia, you have the Oromo stick fighting. It's very much like Tatib in Egypt, and so you have this long stick fighting. Just in the last couple of months, I just found out the Hausa has stick fighting. And it's really, really interesting because it's like what in China they call long pole fighting, you know, where you hold the stick at the end and you're kind of sideways and you're striking with the tip of the stick. You know, again, one of the challenges, I think, is given the orientation towards the oral tradition in Africa, I think that may be that one might have to draw upon that as a source to understand like the beginnings of these traditions. But I think it's safe to say, especially with wrestling, that these are you know, that some of these arts are arts that have certainly gone on since time immemorial. What the diversity of them, I think, demonstrates is, however, is that that combat arts appears to be a type of cultural universe. I don't really like that word universal, but it seems to be a very common adaptation of people to that circumstance. So for instance, like one of the things, like my Capoeira teacher talks about this a lot, and I've heard others, you know, make similar points, is that, you know, in terms of speculating in terms of the genealogy of these arts, that it's quite possible that, for instance, like the wrestling styles, for instance, it's not without significance that the match ends when the person is tossed to the ground. You know, and my suspicion has generally been that the first thing in terms of the you know, I'll get into a little bit later on how these arts are situated as a type of social activity. But in terms of the origins of these things, one of the things that I generally presumed is that the wrestling, for all of the types of purposes that it serves in communal life, that it also served as a way of developing combative skills. If I'm on the battlefield, I throw my adversary to the ground, you know, and if I'm armed with a blade, with the edged weapon, they're probably as good as dead anyway, right? Because, you know, they're in a far less defensible position having been thrown to the ground, at least in terms of how combat appears to have been conceived in much of Africa. And so I generally had kind of presumed that this idea of putting the person on the ground, whether they were on their back, their side, whatever the case may be, was a sort of it was a symbol of defeat, of them having been defeated, you know, in battle. Even when you look at and so one of the things that I think is the case is that I think many of these combat traditions derive from actual fighting, that is, actual military encounters of groups. I'll give two other examples of this. If you look at the style of stick fighting in Southern Africa, again, I mean, as people are fighting with sticks, but if you read about Shaka and his process of developing the spear, utilizing the spear as a melee weapon rather than a projectile weapon. The stick, the use of the stick, for striking is really just a proxy for the use of the spear, for stabbing, for thrusting, for slicing, and so on. And so it was clear that even in Southern Africa, and again, I mean, it's possible that the stick fighting tradition preceded that, but to me, I think I do suspect often that if this is a way to train people, to enable people to sharpen their skills, because you do sharpen a lot of those skills in terms of how you block, how you parry, how you get openings, how you use your footwork, how you maneuver, and so on. So I think that a lot of these combat traditions, their roots may have been the traditions of warfare, and that these became mechanisms of training people for war. And in some cases, this is very, you know, more or less explicit. Desh Obi, I know in his book, Fighting for Honor, talks about this, how in the present day Angola, how for many of the groups from whom we inherit an art like Capoeira, for instance, that their game Ngolo, which was the mother of Capoeira and other arts in the diaspora, was a way of young men demonstrating their prowess, but also a way of training for war. One of the things that he writes, which is fascinating to me, he says that for many of the militaries in this region of Southwest and West Central Africa, that the infantry would not go into battle armed with shields. And so he speculates that the use of evasive movements was a way of surviving on the battlefield. Again, someone thrusts a blade at me, I avoid the blow and maybe return the thrust rather than pairing with the shield. And so some have speculated that, and I think it's a reasonable, you know, argument, that these arts were also mediums. They were mediums to refine people's capacity in war. But I think also because of the complexities of social life, and because to a large extent, I mean, certainly war is a part of social activity in Africa, just like any other part of the world. But it's only really under situations of duress that we find societies that were fully committed to the act of war. You know, I'm thinking about Dahomey, you know, in the 19th century, for example. But that's more of an anomaly really than anything else. And so what happened during peacetime, which was really most of the time, you know, if you look at the totality of African history, many of these arts took on dimension within the community, whether it was tools of manhood, parts of the manhood rights of different peoples. And so like, you know, in the stick fighting among the Oromo, Ngolo in Southwestern Africa, these were things in the traditional context that were used to demonstrate the mettle of young men, which would demonstrate their suitability to take a mate. You also had like the, in Sudan, and I forgot the name of the group, they have a style of fighting with wrist knives. So you put a blade on the wrist and you fight. The Hausa had this too, which is interesting. I don't know if the blades are the same, but one of the things that happens is that this is a ritual. Again, this is ritualistic combat. And so one of the things that will happen is that they'll engage in combat over the fields before planting. And the idea is to draw blood. And the blood is, you know, is supposed to, you know, enrich, you know, the harvest. And so again, this is certainly these are warriors who are giving their blood, but they're giving their blood not just for the sake of vanity, but for the sake of contributing to the community's well-being. So I think that when we look at the origins of these arts, I think the vectors are probably multiple, but I think it's plausible to say that the way in which people had to survive encounters certainly with other groups, and also of course with nature, right? My teacher, Kapoti, she practices an Ethiopian stick fighting art called Dula Mekata, and he talks about how, in terms of some of the, he says that there, you know, when he was learning it, I think from his teachers, he had learned that they would say that there were people in East Africa who were so proficient with the stick that they could, you know, go up against a lion. Now, that's a lot of prowess being able to take on a dangerous animal like this. So it's quite likely that these arts emerge in response to the challenges of nature. And then of course the perils posed by other human beings, but I think also a catalyst for the evolution was the need to institutionalize these arts in such a way so that they somehow optimize daily life. And I think the connections of them with various types of rights was a feature of that. And so, yeah, you know, people talk about the martial arts, and a lot of people, they point to Asia as the birthplace of the martial arts, but that's really a problematic way of thinking. I think it's reasonable to presume that people the world over face similar challenges. Again, dangers from nature, dangers from other humans, and they develop means to respond to those.
So I wanted to pull on this thread because it was very interesting, because when you were talking and you mentioned this, but I want to pull on it, you know, the context of war as being something. I mean, because again, when we think about war, we generally, that's even a distorted view because, you know, it's always conflict. But that's to be honest with you, that's a European construct, a way of looking at the world because of tribal fights, you know, before Europe became Europe. And what is interesting here is in something that you said during peacetime, the ritual of combat arts, mm-hmm. Also being obviously linked to nature, right? So you mm-hmm. also had to make sure that it was a social process mm-hmm. of discipline. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about the actually, let's move into the idea of war itself, mm-hmm. because, you know, sometimes people would think that it was just a mass extinction. You know, you go to mm-hmm. war, there was a mass extinction. Could you talk mm-hmm. a little bit more of how war was implemented in the context of the fighting arts?
Yeah. I really appreciate that you asked that, because I think, you know, the challenge for Africans living in this part of the world is that European premises are presumed to be universal when they're anything but. Right. And I appreciate the more of us who are aware of that, the more it enables us to critically engage with the African practices, African worldview, and so on. So, you know, when you think about, yeah, this idea, war existed certainly in the African continent. But I would argue that the way in which war was executed in many societies, traditional societies, civilizations, empires, kingdoms, that oftentimes the conception, the execution of war were quite different. The first example that comes to mind, I was thinking about, it was a documentary I saw a number of years ago. I think this is back in the 2000s. It was an old documentary then, if I remember correctly. Maybe it wasn't. It was a video of stick fighting in East Africa. So it was the Oromo stick fighting. And you had the men from one community and the men from another community.
We are currently listening to a recent conversation I had with Dr. Kamal Rashid, where we are exploring embodied resistance, the science and continuities of African fighting arts. Due to time constraints, you can listen to the entire program by accessing it through your favorite podcast platform. Search Africa World Now Project. Dr. Kamal Rashid is an associate professor of educational foundations and inquiry at National Lewis University in Chicago. Kamal earned his PhD and MBA from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and his Master of Arts degree from Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid's work focuses on African-American history and culture, particularly the intergenerational dynamics of Africana social critique, which includes an exploration and theorizing of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as contemporary African-centered scholars and critical race theorists. Undergirding this, he studies art, hip-hop, and comics as a radical public pedagogy. He is co-developing an oral history and archival project focused on African-American social movements in the Chicago area from the 1960s to the 1980s with Dr. Richard Benson of Spelman College. He is currently working on Finding Our Way Through the Desert, Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, and the Critical Theory of W.E.B. Du Bois, The Struggle for Humanity. He has published a number of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters and received various grant awards to support his work. Lastly, and most importantly, Dr. Rashid is active in a number of community organizations in the Chicago area, including the Comedic Institute of Chicago, a research and educational organization focused on mapping, exploring, and applying the contributions of ancient Nile Valley civilizations. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Continue to enjoy the program.
Fighting in East Africa. So it was the Oromo stick fighting. And you had the men from one community and the men from another community, and they met up and they were gonna go at it. And the purpose, the conflict was over water access. So they weren't, you know, so it wasn't fighting, they weren't fighting to enlarge, you know, their lands or fighting over the right to dominate another group. They were fighting over access to this particular water reserve. And, you know, in effect, they had established this protocol whereby these combatants from each group would fight, and the victors would have the rights. And this was a type of negotiation. You know, it wasn't let's go over there and slaughter all those people. It was, you know, let's find some means that we can settle this conflict, and you know, we'll go from there. So it's interesting, and it makes sense. And I also, when you were talking, I thought about warfare, particularly in the ancient Nile Valley. You know, there's been this this thing that's been happening where you have a number of white scholars who have been talking about the Black Pharaohs, and I'm amused by that term to no end. And you know, of course, the relationship between Egypt and Nubia was a complicated relationship. But what's interesting is that when you look at the literature, and Mario Beatty has a wonderful paper about this in terms of how the conception of the Nubians was represented in the language in ancient Egypt and what those terms signified. You know, you had in terms of, you know, many white scholars have represented this idea of the Egyptian orientation, the Kemetic orientation towards the Nubians as being one of an oppressor, really, in the sense of what the British were in Ghana, you know, in the Gold Coast, I should say, right, in the late 19th, early 20th century, the sort of idea of the occupying power, when it seems like the relationship was a lot more complicated than that, a lot more complex than that, especially given that these are civilizations who it would appear have been engaged in exchange with each other for millennia. And certainly there were conflicts, but it's also very interesting that those conflicts did not result in the eradication of any of these groups. Those conflicts, in fact, did not result in the cultural erasure of either of these groups, which is very interesting. And so it does beg the question of how did Africans, even ancient Africans, conceive of war? I think one of the challenges that we have, even in terms of thinking about this, is much of what has happened on the continent over the course of the last three centuries has been distorted, right? It's been this framework of distortion. But if we look, like I'm thinking about the wars between Ashanti and Nchita, you know, that really led to the formation of the Ashanti Empire, and maybe some of the subsequent wars between Ashanti and Akwapim. These were wars that changed the balance of power, but these were that reordered power within those regions. But these were also not wars that sought to bring about the eradication of groups. That is, you know, the people who established Nchita, you know, I mean, certainly their leaders were deposed, but the people themselves continued to exist. Even one of the oldest of the Akan empires, the Barong, you know, those people were deposed, of course, by later groups, but they continued to exist. You know, they exist today. You can go in, you know, in central Ghana, you know, and they're still alive. And so this African orientation to war was not one that I think in the sort of European sense that one goes in and the idea is to just slaughter everyone. It seems that the scope of warfare in Africa was very limited. And I think, and my sense is that part of what may have been at the heart of that is this conception of humanity, right? I think that there was an orientation into demarcating the scope of war relative to this conception of humanity, that is, that human life is valuable, and therein the focus of war being constrained relative to the objectives of war. Whether that's in deposing a particular polity, whether that's preventing the expansion of a particular group, whatever the case may be. And again, it's not, you know, and it's not to say that people did not lose their lives. They did. You know, there was a loss of life in war. But I'm not aware of anything analogous in terms of the traditional and the classical African context that's equal to the war. So the level of warfare, the scale of warfare, the intensity of warfare that originally characterized much of European history, especially since the fall of the Roman Empire, but I guess since the rise of the Roman Empire, you know, we're talking about a very violent history, and so it's very puzzling, you know, in a lot of respects that in the contemporary context, you know, Africa is sort of the poster child, and Black people, not just people on the continent, but Black people, even Black people in the diaspora, the poster child of violence. When in fact, if you look at totality of human violence over the last 1,000 years, there's a winner in that. There's a champion, and that champion is not Africa or the African world. So anyway, going back to the first example that I gave, though, and I'll give one last example, and I'll put this in a framework. You know, one of the things that people talk about is how prior to Shaka developing I think it's Asajj, the spear as a melee weapon as opposed to a projectile weapon, that much of the orientation towards warfare in Southern Africa was symbolic, you know, that a show of force was what occurred, but there was a significant, constraints with respect to the loss of life. And I think that what that may illustrate is that within the context of the African society, warfare took on multiple dimensions. That is, that warfare could be real, that is, people engaging in open hostilities with each other, and warfare also being orchestrated in a symbolic form. And what's interesting about that, you actually have the continuation of that in the Americas. You know what's kind of interesting? The jogo de capoeira, the game of capoeira, could be an example of that symbolic war. When I was growing up, breakdance battles, you know, I mean, I'm told by people a little older than me, that like in Chicago, there was a point where the gangs wouldn't even fight. They just show up and break dance against each other. Again, that was before my time. But it's interesting, this idea of symbolic warfare as a way of mediating or as a way of resolving conflict. So I think the point here, though, I think, is that in the African context, war took on several, a number of forms, that it wasn't just open hostility, and, you know, that resulted in the loss of human life, but war could also be orchestrated in symbolic fashion, which diminished the loss of life, but still gave an agreed upon framework for conceiving of whatever type of political or economic revision was being enacted, if that may, or effected.
No, that's a very important point, because I mean, this human conceptualization, which is something that I am very much interested in and studying, it's, you know, in the context for me, in the context of resistance movements, but also in this contestation of human rights and, you know, and this and conceptualization of philosophically of duties and responsibilities from indigenous African systems, which moves us to the second part of our discussion, which I wanted to talk about how what we just discussed transmitted itself or through embodied knowledge and memory to the diaspora. And you mentioned Capoeira, but I want to do something real quick before we do that. And I think this is important because I think it'll lead you into really talking about it, talking about the second component is, how did you yourself come to all of this? this knowledge or this particular, you know, form of discourse or knowledge system?
Yeah, and, I appreciate that.
Yeah, and lead into this embodied knowledge. And again, here I'm thinking about because something you mentioned earlier, the adaptation to circumstances was something that, you know, may have caused conflict, or you had to negotiate through symbolic combat or do real combat. So now I'm thinking Africans being snatched from the continent, moving into, because this is going to get into the second part of this embodied knowledge that Africans, a lot of times we talk about culture and, you know, we talk about the artifacts of culture in Africa, but we don't talk about the fact that, you know, even in the Haitian Revolution, these people understood how to battle.
That's right.
You know, and even in the context of the of revolts against the plantation, they understood how to wage resistance. Before we really get into that, talk about how you came to all of this. And you mentioned your teacher a couple of times in Capoeira, but kind of jump on in there for me.
Yeah. You know, I, throughout my childhood, you know, kind of like you, I used to go over my aunt's house, and me and my cousins would sit around watching Kung Fu movies. And so I wanted to learn, you know, the martial arts bad. And of course, you know, back then, this is like the late 70s, early 80s, really the thing that I knew of that was readily available was karate. But for whatever reason, you know, my mother wouldn't sign me up. I don't know, you know, years later, she told me that she told me that my stepfather didn't want me to learn. And then years later, she said, no, I didn't want anybody to hit you. And I'm like, people are jumping on me in school. There are people throwing blows, you know? So anyway, you know, I was very interested in the martial arts growing up, but not unable to study the martial arts. My stepfather and I would kind of box, and it wasn't like technical boxing, you know. And so I'm not sure if what we were doing was some kind of sort of folk orientation of boxing, or if it was, you know, just there's an interpretation of boxing. I'm not sure. You know, I never got a chance to figure out the genealogy, but it was pretty basic, you know, some basic strikes, some blocks and things like that. It wasn't anything very complicated. And so finally, when I got to college, I started studying the martial arts. And my first encounter was an eclectic art that blended elements of boxing, jiu-jitsu, judo, kido, karate. So it was wrestling. So it was a mixed art. And it was in that time, I was in undergrad, and it was a brother that I knew, and he mentioned this art to me called capoeira. And he started doing the Jenga, and I don't know what he was doing. It was like he was dancing or something. And he mentioned this movie, Only the Strong. So I went home, I rented the movie, and I watched it. It was interesting, but at the same time, I didn't really connect with it. But I think it planted, you know, this idea in my mind, because even as a young adult, I was very much interested in us, very much focused on us, very much desirous of understanding our history and culture. And it was really not until that moment that this idea of African martial arts, that really wasn't something that I had really contemplated, had really pondered. And so it was at that moment, you know, where that idea was, I think, planted in my mind. And so at the end of the 90s, I was teaching at this, I was working at this community center on the south side of Chicago. And there was a group that taught a capoeira class at this park, probably about a half mile away, maybe a mile away from this community center. But the class was on the same day that I worked, so I couldn't get to the class. And so I was like, man, so I'm trying to figure out a way I can do this. I ended up in the interim studying this Chinese martial art. And then I ended up going back to get my doctorate back at the U of I in Champaign. Illinois. And while I was there, studied a couple of different Asian martial arts. There was the capoeira group there, but I didn't want to study with them because it was a primarily white capoeira group. And I've always had this issue about whites being the mediators of black knowledge. That just always seemed unacceptable to me. So I kind of waited, but it finally, it was in the spring of 2005 where I was like, you know what, I'm gonna figure out a way to do this. Because what had happened between 99 and 2005, not only had my desire to understand the African martial arts grown, but I even had actually, I may have started a Yahoo group. So this is back when people were using Yahoo groups. It was called the African Warrior Tradition. I may have started it maybe in 2006, so it was a little bit after then, but I had become, you know, in some ways an exponent of this thing, even though I was still looking for a way in. So finally, I ended up emailed Kalindi Yee. I think I emailed him. I don't know how I got his email address, but Kalindi Yee was, he passed away last summer. But Kalindi was, Ahati Kalindi Yee was probably one of the biggest, I think, exponents of the African fighting. So I got in contact with him. He told me, this is spring 2005. He said, hey, well, I have a camp in Michigan in June. You're welcome to come. And I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, I don't know how I got the money because I was in grad school. I was broke, you know. I mean, I was broke, and I was even more broke over the summer. If you haven't been in grad school, you don't know what that means, but the summers were lean, you know. So I got my money together. I drove my little car up to Michigan. And up there, I got some exposure. He has a stick fighting art he does. It's basically Tati, we call it Naboot. And I'd been working on that a little bit he had a video that he put out. I was kind of going along with that. But when I got up there, I got to get some hands-on instruction. And I also met a brother there named Mestre Petrovella, also known as Dennis Newsom. And he was a capoeira teacher. And so I think that may have been my second lesson in capoeira, but it was the most thorough. I think before then, a brother I knew tried to show me a little bit, and I was like, this just feels weird. But that brother, he showed me some, and that was my foundation. So I probably had this much knowledge in the African martial arts, but I was determined to run with it. And so my goal really at that point so that was June 2005, my goal at that point was really to make this a way of life. You know, I was already committed to the martial arts from the 90s, from when I first started training in the Asian martial arts back in 94. And so for me, martial arts is a way of life. It was something that I was committed to, but I really wanted to immerse myself very deeply in these African arts. And I think for me, and this is something that I became more consciously aware of during that period, like from 2000, just before then. So I want to say maybe about 2002 to throughout to the end of that decade, it became clear to me increasingly that whereas I appreciated like the technical efficiency of an art like Wing Chun, where I appreciated the sort of history and the philosophy of an art like Chole Foot is one of the Chinese arts that I picked up. I felt throughout that time a certain degree of alienation, you know, whereas I appreciated the history and the philosophy of these arts, they also were someone else's history. They were also someone else's philosophy in a lot of respects. And for me, the question inevitably returned to, and it was the same question that a seven-year-old asked me 3 years ago. He said, Baba, how do Africans fight? You know, and that was, and I didn't phrase it like that, but that was the question in my mind. Like, how do Africans fight? And moreover, the other part of that question, and how did those fighting arts inform what we did over here relative to our experience? And so I moved to St. Louis in 2006. So this is a year after I go to that camp. And I was looking around because I figure I'm in a city now. I was in Champaign, Illinois before. So I figure I'm in a bigger city. I should be able to find a capoeira group. Eventually I found this brother named Teboho. At the time he was with a capoeira group called Coraje Oro. And I trained with their brother. I don't know how many times I went per week, but I was training with their brother every week. I was like, I'm going to get this, you know? And so I was doing that. I was also practicing that stick fighting art. Basically it's Tati, but Pati Ahati Kalindi referred to as Naboot. And those were my arts, you know? And so one of the things that I began to do that I became interested in was not only learning these arts, but popularizing them. So like I said, it was around that time I started a Yahoo group called the African Warrior Tradition. Again, I had this much knowledge about the African arts, but I was an exponent, you know. I invited I was a professor at St. Louis Community College at the time. And on at least two occasions, I was able to bring somebody. I brought a Hati Kalindi Iyi down, I want to say in 2007. And then in 2009, I brought a brother named Meshri Terry Baruti in, who teaches capoeira in San Francisco, but basically the Bay Area in California. And he came in with two of his country mestres, and it was right on time, you know, because these brothers, you know, one of the things that was a challenge for me with capoeira was, and this is going to go back to something I mentioned earlier, much of capoeira has been reduced to the folkloric, you know, or to the level of symbolic combat. And so this explicit articulation of capoeira as a combat art, as a type of, people like the term martial science. I'm not the biggest fan of that word, but people will use that term. That is one thing, something that I was always looking for. Like, because when you read these accounts, when I was still in Champaign, this is even before 2005. Again, I was reading this stuff. I didn't have the access to instruction, but I'm studying. I found Desh Obi's master's thesis, you know, and I'm reading this and I'm like, this is, well, I mean, it was an account in there. This is from the Southern U.S. This is on Sunday, you know, on Sunday, black folks was often left to their own devices. And so the plantation owner finds out that the black folks are off and they off having a good time. And he's like, you know, he sends the overseers to go break up this gathering. And they go over there, they get beat down. And when they get back, they was like, yeah, that dude, he was there and he wasn't having it. And basically, Desh Obi, you know, the speculation was that this was one of the brothers who was knowledgeable in these African arts, because he sure didn't learn no karate, you know, but he knew how to fight. So what was it he was fighting with? And so it was texts like those that made me very desirous of getting this knowledge. And so at any rate, I had become an exponent. And so I bought those two brothers down. And again, Meshri Terry Baruti, one of the things that I appreciated about what they presented, capoeira as a combat science. And so that was something that I was greatly appreciative of. When I got back to Chicago, it's 2009, I was again kind of in this liminal space. You know, I wanted to continue my study, but also realized that I had like limited resources in terms of information. And that was a constant source of frustration. And really what's clear to me is that from 99 all the way into the 2000s, you know, 2010s, really this idea of not having information was a source of frustration. There were a couple of things that were happening. Like 52 Blocks was now much more visible on the scene. 52 Blocks or Jailhouse Boxing. And I knew of it from back in the 2000s, but hadn't seen anybody who was teaching it, you know, and so on. And so throughout the 2010s, there's sort of this gradual expansion, I think, for me in terms of just access to information. And really not even throughout the 2000s, probably like in the latter half of this decade. What happened in 2011, I ended up teaching capoeira at the request of this parent in this homeschool group that my children were a part of, that my family was a part of, really. And I didn't really feel that I was qualified to teach capoeira, but, you know, they wanted knowledge. And I said, well, I'll share with them the capoeira that I know. But what was interesting is that after that, I kept falling into situations where people were inviting me to teach capoeira. And so I was like, well, if people want me to teach this thing, let me share what I know. And eventually I was clear that I needed to know more of this. I need to go deeper into this art. And so finally in 2017, I got a grant, a research grant from the university that I work for, National Lewis University, a C grant. And what I wanted to do was study African martial arts as African centered pedagogy. That was the idea. And so what I was going to do is to host three events. I actually started in the summer of 2016. I bought Dr. Edward Poe to Chicago. He's a brother. He lives in Madison, Wisconsin. He studied with Mestre Pastinha in Bahia back in the late 1960s. So he taught a workshop. There was another brother at the time. He was with a couple of this other capoeira. We about studied with him a little bit back in 2014. He came and taught in the fall, I think, of 2016. And then in 2017, I bought in Damon Stith from Austin. You know, he taught some African stick and blade fighting, left 52 blocks, little capoeira. And then in May of that year, brought Mestre Pedro Vela, my capoeira teacher. And it was interesting because, again, this is the first brother that I really, you know, this is the brother really who I got my formal introduction to capoeira with, and I've stayed in contact with him throughout that whole time. And so, you know, when he's here, I'm looking at this brother, and I'm like, you know what, this is the person I need to be studying with. And all this time I've been telling myself that it really wouldn't be feasible for me to take on a teacher, you know, who wasn't in the region, wasn't in the Midwest, because I was like, the economics of it wouldn't work out. But I said, you know what, I'm gonna just figure it out. You know, so I asked the brother if I could learn from him, and I've been studying with him ever since. And so that was my, you know, and from him, I've learned capoeira. Makulele, which is the stick fighting that you see in Capoeira, Kalinda, which is an African-American stick fighting, and so on. And since then, and more recently, I've been studying with Professor Mo in 52 Blocks. Again, I had a little bit of 52 Blocks from different people, you know, who'd show me different things over the years, but this brother enabled me to take a deep dive. And so that's been my path in these arts to the present.
No, and that's important, because what's happening here is what you just demonstrated in your answer is the idea of embodied knowledge and how memory is carried over through movement, not only through thought, but also which goes back to, you know, this notion of memory and being brought over. Right. Yeah. So we talked about we went over the history when we went over the origins of that. But now let's talk about it in a specific, and let's look at it through Capoeira. Let's look at it through the origins of Capoeira and how it, you know, was that particular form, did it evolve, or was it something else before it came across, the body of water, the Atlantic Ocean? Mm-hmm. How did that develop, and how much of it is similar to the ancient styles or the other styles of, across the continent? Or is it an amalgamation? Yeah. Different forms.
Yeah, it's a very good question. You know, one of the things that's, like, if you look at the data, I think it's roughly 35%, a little less than 35% of enslaved Africans brought to this country came from the Congo, Angola area. And it looks like, you know, whenever you look throughout the Americas, wherever you had these significant populations of these Blacks from the Congo, Angola region, you have a capoeira like art, right? An art derived from Angola, which is this fight dance tradition of that part of Africa. So in the Americas, lights off in the rest of town, still vacant in the early hours. Turn
ahead. We were just listening to a recent conversation I had with Dr. Kamal Rashid, where we were exploring embodied resistance, the science and continuities of African fighting arts. Dr. Kamal Rashid is an associate professor of educational foundations and inquiry at National Lewis University in Chicago. Kamal earned his PhD and BA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a Master of Arts degree from Northeastern Illinois University. Dr. Rashid's work focuses on African American history and culture, particularly on the intergenerational dynamics of Africana social critique, which includes an exploration and theorizing of W.E.B. Du Bois, as well as contemporary African-centered scholars and critical race theorists. Undergirding this work, he studies art, hip-hop, and comics as a radical public pedagogy. He is co-developing an oral history and archival project focused on African-American social movements in the Chicago area from the 1960s to the 1980s with Dr. Richard Benson of Spelman College, and is currently working on Finding Our Way Through the Desert, Jacob H. Carruthers and the Restoration of an African Worldview, and the Critical Theory of W.E.B. Du Bois, The Struggle for Humanity. He has published a number of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters and received various grant awards to support his work. Due to time constraints, you can listen to the entire program by accessing it through your favorite podcast platform. Just search Africa World Now Project. Still vacant. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ or Instagram at Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Muntali, Africa World Now Project's media correspondent Funa Ngonda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on SoundCloud and Spotify podcasts. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, above all, be intelligent.
Something said.